Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jeff Cohen, journalism professor and co-founder of Roots Action, who discusses the anger among many Bernie Sanders supporters in response to Hillary Clinton's choice of Virginia Senator Tim Kaine as her vice presidential running mate. Frederick Clarkson of Political Research Associates, who assesses the Republican Party's continued fealty to culture war policies advocated by the Christian right. And Ann Rolface, founding director of the Louisiana Bucket Brigade, who talks about the local campaign to end new oil and gas drilling in the Gulf of Mexico and the effort to enlist national environmental groups in the cause. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For the first time in 16 years, the International United Nations AIDS Conference returned to South Africa, the epicenter of the global AIDS pandemic. The AIDS crisis has changed dramatically since 2000, as thousands of HIV-infected people in southern Africa are now receiving drug treatment. However, AIDS activists are concerned that the number of people infected with HIV is growing again, even as world leaders boldly proclaim the end of AIDS. Between 2010 and 2015, there was a 57% increase in HIV infections in Eastern Europe and Central Asia, even as infections in Caribbean nations continued to decline. In June, the UN General Assembly passed a resolution urging more resources be committed to the goal of ending the AIDS pandemic by 2030. But over the last 3 years, funding for AIDS treatment contributed by international donors fell by $1.5 billion annually. In hard-hit communities in South Africa, antiviral treatments have saved many lives. Back in 2002, a children's AIDS hospice near Johannesburg witnessed 87 infants die. Yet after the South African government began treating pregnant women with antiviral drugs, the number of infants who succumbed to the disease fell dramatically. Experience has shown that educating impoverished girls in South Africa has effectively reduced the likelihood that they and their babies will be infected with HIV later in life. Alarmed by the growing Zika virus, women activists in Brazil are working to reform that South American nation's harsh abortion laws. They're campaigning to give pregnant women with Zika access to safe abortions. Pregnant women with Zika are at risk of giving birth to infants born with abnormally small heads, a condition known as microcephaly, as well as other birth defects. Currently, women in Brazil with Zika cannot terminate their pregnancies even if tests find birth defects are present in their unborn babies. Over the winter, health authorities in 5 Latin American nations urged women not to become pregnant. Lawyers from the Yale University-based Global Health Justice Partnership concluded that existing Brazilian laws on reproductive health violate the human rights of women. The partnership charges that the government has failed to enact adequate measures to ensure that all women have access to comprehensive reproductive health information or options. Brazilian activists are now pushing for an emergency court ruling to give women with Zika the right to an abortion. Deborah Diniz, a law professor at the University of Brasilia, insisted, "This is an emergency. We have an epidemic, and the epidemic shows the face of Brazilian inequality." Long before Donald Trump campaigned for president, proclaiming his anti-immigration positions, Arizona's Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Greater Phoenix engaged in racial profiling and harassment of new immigrants. According to the American Prospect, the sheriff's office has paid $140 million in damages resulting from multiple lawsuits and in May was found in contempt of a court order on racial profiling. Opposition to Arpaio's conduct has mobilized Latino voters in the Grand Canyon state. Over the last 12 years, Latino registration in Arizona has increased by 165%, and political observers say the surging Latino vote could topple Republican Senator John McCain, who faces a tight re-election fight. This fall, organizers hope to mobilize 1 million Latino voters in Arizona. But the rate of political participation among Latinos is much lower than other Arizonans, with many of those eligible for naturalization opting not to apply. One consequence of low voter numbers is that Latinos are vulnerable to right-wing-inspired policies such as the controversial anti-immigrant law SB 1070, which was passed by the state legislature and signed into law in 2010. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
On the Friday before the Democratic National Convention was preparing to kick off in Philadelphia on July 25th, the long-standing efforts to unify the party, after a fractious primary campaign, were upended with WikiLeaks' release of over 19,000 internal DNC emails. Those emails from seven key figures within the party document discussions that explored ways in which the DNC could undermine Bernie Sanders' campaign as he was fighting to overtake frontrunner Hillary Clinton. One email from the Democrats' chief financial officer, Brad Marshall, suggested that they use religion against a certain possible atheist with a Jewish heritage, presumably Senator Sanders. While many Bernie Sanders supporters had long charged that the DNC rigged the primary system to favor former Secretary of State Clinton, the WikiLeaks emails appeared to confirm their accusations. Large numbers of delegates immediately called for the firing of DNC chair, Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who turned in her resignation. Soon after, however, Clinton appointed Wasserman Schultz honorary chair of her campaign's 50-state program. But for all the anger about the leaked DNC emails, Hillary Clinton's choice of Virginia Senator Tim Kaine as her vice presidential running mate was a far more serious blunder in the view of many in the party's progressive wing. While Bernie Sanders' progressive platform won 46% of pledged delegates in the primary campaign, Clinton chose a centrist Democrat, whose positions on free trade, banking deregulation, and reproductive rights are the polar opposite of nearly half the party. Your reporter spoke with journalism professor Jeff Cohen, co-founder of the group Roots Action, and communications coordinator of the Bernie Delegates Network. Here, Cohen explains why he believes the choice of Kaine is a colossal mistake that could put Donald Trump in the White House.
I mean, it's very rare where you have a losing candidate, and obviously we know from the emails that in spite of an unfair system, an unlevel playing field during the primary process, Bernie Sanders, an insurgent candidate, got 45% of the Democratic Party primary and caucus voters. It's quite an achievement. So I'm hearing a lot of people from Team Clinton saying, we need party unity, we need party unity. Well, the best way to have achieved party unity or a center-left alliance against Trump would have been to choose a vice presidential running mate other than Tim Kaine. It would have been to choose a vice presidential running mate that might bridge to the other wing of the party that's so wary of Hillary Clinton. Even Donald Trump did that. Trump chose as his vice presidential running mate Governor Pence, who had endorsed Ted Cruz. So it's not that unusual, and it was especially needed in the Democratic Party. Unfortunately, Senator Kaine, he's one of just a dozen Democratic senators who voted last year to fast-track Trans-Pacific Partnership. In many ways, he's in the conservative wing of the Democratic Party. So it was seen as sort of a poke in the eye when Hillary Clinton had this opportunity to try to bridge to the progressives and really build an alliance against Trump. And instead, she went with one of the more conservative Democrats in the U.S. Senate.
Jeff Cohen, I've read commentaries that try to rationalize Hillary Clinton's pick of Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia as her running mate by saying the left has nowhere else to go and that they will come into the fold and vote for Hillary in November. It's the independent voters that might be drawn to Donald Trump that she is trying to get with the nomination of Tim Kaine to be her vice presidential running mate. What do you make of that strategy?
Yeah. you're right that that's almost a mainstream media mantra, but I haven't heard that much today because it's finally dawned on the moronic mainstream media pundits that the Bernie supporters have somewhere to go. They have a home. They can stay home, or they could vote for Jill Stein, the Green Party. So it was a very, very stupid and risky strategy. What you're laying out is exactly what Team Clinton has been spinning and their friends in the punditocracy. I could count the ways that it's bad strategy if your goal is to defeat Trump and defeat him handily in November. First of all, you could go after these imaginary moderate Republicans. Maybe there's 13 of them left in the country. But there's 13 million people that voted for Bernie Sanders. And if you choose someone like Tim Kaine, who's got this position on corporate trade, even within the last week, he signed on to a letter wanting to deregulate banks. I mean, if you choose someone like Tim Kaine, and by the way, he's a smart guy. Everyone says he's a very nice guy. He's got some liberal positions on especially gun control. He's been particularly brave. You know, he's got some redeeming qualities. But on the main issues that divided Hillary supporters from Bernie supporters, he's almost always on the wrong side. He's on the corporate side. So if you want to help Trump win, you, number one, divide up the Democratic Party by that choice. Two, you choose someone who's quite corporate. And you saw Donald Trump immediately when the choice was made. He's saying, I'm the guy who's standing with the common people, and they've got two corporate Democratic establishment insiders on their ticket. So it makes absolutely no strategic sense. The right strategic move in defeating Trump would be to choose a populist as the VP running mate who could expose the faux populism of a Donald Trump, a billionaire who spent his whole life living in the lap of luxury. So the way to get the independent voters and the swing voters and the Bernie voters is to put someone on the ticket like an Elizabeth Warren or a Sherrod Brown, the senator from Ohio, who even endorsed Hillary, but he's known as a guy who's fought for labor, fought for the working class, fought against NAFTA, fought against these trade deals. You'd put someone on your ticket who's an unmistakable populist and, you know, who's been there for years and years, not someone who wants to weaken regulations of Wall Street or some of the banks, as Tim Kaine's been trying to do in the last week or two.
That was Jeff Cohen, journalism professor and director of the Parks Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College. For more perspectives on the Democrats' vice presidential nominee, Senator Tim Kaine, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In one of the most contentious presidential primary campaigns in recent Republican Party history, billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump emerged victorious out of a crowded field that began with 17 candidates. Despite the fact that Trump has rejected GOP orthodoxy on some issues, such as free trade, privatization of Social Security, and support for NATO, the former reality TV star did attempt to please and retain the loyalty of one key element of the Republican Party coalition, the Christian right. Trump's choice of Indiana Governor Mike Pence, a Christian conservative, as his running mate, was no accident. Although Trump is obviously not very religious, has been married three times, and curses like a sailor, a recent Pew Research Center poll found that nearly four-fifths of evangelical voters in the U.S. are rallying strongly in favor of Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump. Pew pointed out that white evangelical Protestants make up one-fifth of all registered voters in the U.S. and roughly one-third of all voters who say they identify with or lean toward the Republican Party. The just-concluded 2016 Republican National Convention in Cleveland ratified one of the most right-wing party platforms in GOP history. The platform is a gift to the religious right that includes planks reaffirming opposition to abortion and rights for LGBTQ Americans. The platform would also make Christianity the official religion of America, replace sex education with abstinence-only advice for teenagers, and repeal the 50-year-old tax law
that prohibits churches and other tax-exempt organizations from political organizing. Your reporter spoke with Frederick Clarkson, Senior Fellow for Religious Liberty with Political Research Associates, who talks about the Republican Party's continued fealty to culture war policies advocated by the Christian right.
Trump has rearranged party politics in terms of who he is and the kind of politics he represents and the way he campaigns. And the Christian right has never seen anything like him any more than anybody else. But that said, his relationship with some surprising conservative Christian leaders goes back not just 6 months or a year, but for what my colleagues and I can track, 4 or 5 years. And they were already talking about Trump running for president in at least 2011 that we can find. So he's been building a base of support among people who were not ordinarily reached out to. And this has upset the Washington establishment, if we can call them that, conservative Christian leaders who are accustomed to being power brokers. So there's been sort of an insurgency within the Christian right, within the Republican Party, that explains at least some of his evangelical support. But that said, despite his record as a pro-choice Democrat and a pro-choice Republican who was in favor of LGBTQ rights, he's now at least giving lip service to those things in such a way it provides sufficient cover for conservative Christians to support his candidacy. So it's you could say that they're election year conversions, and he hasn't handled it well, but he's being treated with seriousness on that.
What about the party platform? Maybe, Fred, you can review for us. What is in the Republican Party platform this year that is significant in its consistency with Republicans in years past, or any differences that you know?
Well, I can't say I've looked at every detail of the platform, particularly in the area of trade and foreign policy, but my guess is that they're pretty much the same because Trump kind of kept hands off of that stuff as far as I read. I think that the language around abortion and homosexuality is less strident, even though it's clear about where they stand. I think, too, that one thing that does stand out that's different to me, and anybody who goes and looks at it can look at the very beginning, and that's that they are making a deeper appeal to what we call Christian nationalism than perhaps we've ever seen before. And this is the idea that America was founded as a Christian nation and somehow got derailed by some deep conspiracy of liberals and the ACLU and the Supreme Court and the other usual suspects, and must be restored once again to that idea of Christian nationalist greatness. And the way you can see it, where the code words are at the beginning, is a clever invocation of the Declaration of Independence and claiming that there are specifically Christian religious principles embedded within it that were the principles that then led to the writing of the Constitution. Now, the Constitution is very clear about the nature of religion and government, and that is Article 6 says there'll be no religious test for public office. And the Christian right historians who are honest about these things said, yeah, that was a clear break, with any idea of Christian nationalism or any idea of biblical theocracy. But it's an inconvenient thing if you're the contemporary Christian right. You, in order to say that America was founded as a Christian nation, somehow you have to find a religious justification in the Constitution and the intention of the framers, which just isn't there. So the way that they do it is to try to shoehorn in some of the religious language of the Revolutionary Manifesto that we call the Declaration into the intended meaning of the Constitution. That is present in the Republican Party platform. It's been a propaganda theme of the Christian right for many years. You might not notice it unless you're familiar with that stuff, but it's shocking to me that it's present because it's an appeal to a kind of Christian theocracy in dog whistle terms.
And Fred, what is the threat that you see in the Christian right for our democratic system in the United States?
The Christian right is skilled, better skilled than any other faction, to use the democratic processes and the offices and the skill sets that go with them to advance their agenda in order to end democratic processes as we know them and to advance a more theocratic society.
That was Frederick Clarkson, Senior Fellow for Religious Liberty with Political Research Associates. Find more information and analysis on Donald Trump, the Republican Party, and the Christian Right by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In June, a coalition of grassroots environmental justice organizations on the Gulf Coast sent a letter to big green environmental groups and their funders, calling on them to be equal partners in the campaigns they're waging to clean up the air and water in their region, which is likely the area most heavily impacted by oil and gas drilling anywhere across the U.S. The coalition says they want the help these big organizations can provide, but they want a relationship built on mutual respect, and they don't want to be used as poster children for environmental disasters that the national groups often exploit to raise money for their own projects. One of the leading coalition partners is the Louisiana Bucket Brigade, a grassroots environmental health and justice organization working with communities that neighbor the state's oil refineries and chemical plants. Their goal is to create an informed society that holds the petrochemical industry and government accountable for the true costs of pollution. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Ann Rolface, founding director of the Louisiana Bucket Brigade, which, along with allied groups, has launched a campaign to end new oil and gas drilling leases in the Gulf. Here she explains the dynamic that has long prevailed among big green environmental groups and what kind of changes she and other activists are working for.
You know, people are getting polluted. You know, their children can't go outside to play. Their property values are plummeting, and big oil is making off with the profits. What really started this conversation is a campaign that I believe is very attractive to the national groups and also to funders, which is the campaign to end new drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, if you look at this part of the world, a lot of us have been fighting the oil industry and fossil fuels for a long time, but it hasn't been enough people, or it hasn't been strong enough. And so finally, I think we're getting to a point where we have a critical mass. And so we are focused doggedly on this idea that we will end new drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. And that is a call that has not been made in this part of the world. And it is a historic call, and it is really, really a game changer. I think the good news is that the green groups recognize that, and they want to be involved. And now the challenge will simply be to collaborate in the right way.
What are some of the groups working in the Gulf?
There are a lot of groups working in the region. Some of them are based in the small neighborhoods that are polluted. For example, there's a small group that I work with called St. Rose Community One Voice. And then there's a group like the Bucket Brigade that is state-based, and there are groups that are more regional in scope, groups like Bridge the Gulf, the STEPS Coalition. We all work in different ways, and over the years, we've worked together on some projects. And so most recently, I think a lot of us have come together on the campaign to end new leasing and new drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. You know, we've known each other for a long, long time. We've worked together in a lot of different situations.
You mentioned local, state, and regional groups, but the big green groups are national. Have they been involved in the Gulf as well?
The larger green groups get involved sort of on a kind of case-by-case basis. You know, certainly they were here after the BP disaster and after Katrina. You know, I think I met the head of every single big green group during those times. You know, you'll hear from representatives of the big green groups on an occasional basis. And I think one of the long-time issues is that our priorities have not necessarily been aligned. And so, you know, they're wonderful. They provide us help. But it's usually a case of they call when they want us to do something that fits into their agenda rather than a sort of longer-term strategic approach, which says, what are you guys trying to accomplish? How might we align? And I think this letter is really nothing new. You know, groups in this part of the world sent a similar letter to the big greens in the 90s. So I think we're really repeating a dynamic and emphasizing a dynamic that has been here a long time, which is you really miss an opportunity to succeed and to win when you don't really engage people in a full partnership.
Ann Rolfes, the Big Greens usually refer to 10 national well-funded organizations with headquarters in D.C. How did they respond to this letter?
The letter was addressed to funders as well. I mean, to me, that's almost an even more important dynamic, because although there are repeated studies and reports that come out about how it's important to fund the grassroots, I think a recent one was from the Environmental Grantmakers Association. You know, they note that most of the money goes to the big groups, but the grassroots groups could really use it effectively. So the funders continue to fund big groups. You know, when people like us apply, they'll say, oh, you're too small, or funders will repeatedly say, oh, well, you know, groups in the Gulf, they don't get along. They don't work well together. And that is used as an excuse not to fund us. I just think it's time to dispel with some of the stereotypes of the South. You know, we're just as smart as they are. We just don't live in Washington, D.C.
How did the Big Greens and or the funders respond?
You know, I have to say that I have not gotten much feedback from groups. From what I hear from my colleagues, groups are calling and talking to certain people who signed on to the letter. You know, I think it's just a wake-up call. Again, I think it's both common courtesy and good strategy to work with this part of the world in a meaningful and honest and equitable way.
A lot of big green groups want to see an end to all drilling, saying we have to leave all remaining fossil fuels in the ground or risk runaway climate devastation. What do you think of that idea?
I'm definitely an optimist, and I think big. I don't think that it's reasonable to say right now we want to end all drilling right now in the Gulf of Mexico, right? We're not going to win that. But we can say end new leasing of new parts of the Gulf of Mexico, and then a companion part of our call is to hire workers now to repair what is a completely dilapidated oil industry infrastructure, right? They have 27,000 abandoned oil wells in the Gulf of Mexico. If you look at their refineries, they're rusty, they're falling apart. There are a lot of good jobs helping the oil industry just get its act together.
That was Ann Rolfes, founding director of the Louisiana Bucket Brigade. Learn more about the campaign to end oil and gas leases in the Gulf by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.